I'm not going to try to sell this book every week, but I'm going to try twice. Everybody who bought it last week told me how much they appreciated it. This is Narayani Anaya's story of her 10 years with Swami Kriyananda, which were the last years of Swami's life. It's a beautiful Christmas book because it's just you just sit down and read it for an afternoon, and it really brings the presence and the experience of Swamiji really close. So we have them in our boutique. That's all. This particular reading about the 10 virgins, which Swami doesn't even bother to have the whole biblical story because it's so complicated, and every time I end up having to speak on it, I always talk about how much I don't like it. So I'm not going to say that this time. Actually, I saw it from another angle, which actually interested me, so I'm very interested in it today. It came out partly because yesterday I was giving a class about, I think the title was called Cradling the Baby Jesus. It wasn't our most popular class, but those of us who came had a really good time. And Ramurti, who was responsible for the title, which I wasn't really happy about until he explained it, and then I really liked it. He reminded me of things that I myself have said. When you talk as much as I do, you're vulnerable. Because you always said it somewhere and someone can wave it back at you. But I often talk at Christmas appropriately about the spiritual bhav of loving God as a baby, which is really not at all common in the West. We do it at Christmas, but we don't actually know what we're doing. We celebrate it more just like a happy story and the angels. I mean, if you stick with us through Christmas, you're going to see a lot of angels and shepherds and wise men, and we just play the story out to the absolute hilt. On Christmas Day, we play it out for children, which is even gives us all more license to allow ourselves to really enter into it. But in the Indian tradition, worshiping God as a baby, which is so paradoxical to our mind, is common. Almost every god has a child and a baby form. So when you, I don't know, I suppose you go to the Murti store, you go to the store where all the statues are, and you decide what you're going to have in your home, or you inherit them over generations, and you go into traditional Hindu homes, and they'll have a little temple area, and they'll have their gods. The Murti means statue, but a Murti is an image of God. It's just a statue until it becomes enlivened by your devotion. And the little baby that we know the most about is Krishna, because there's all the stories about Krishna and how he steals the butter and how he teases his mother and all these different things. And you can buy little Murtis of little baby Gopal crawling along. He has a different name. You have little baby ones, and it's just a little fat, chubby little child holding the ball of butter that he's stolen. And it's totally confusing to us that somebody would put that on an altar and then consider that to be an image of God. But what we have to come back to and what we have to really understand is even those images are put there because it's a way for us to focus and therefore to awaken the natural love of the heart, and then to, by disciplined, consistent reverence, to train ourselves to have this spontaneous loving reaction. And if you think about all of life and all of the spiritual path, that's really what we're trying to do, isn't it? We're trying to have a spontaneous loving reaction to everything that happens to us, whether it's the sight of an individual, whether it's somebody being really unkind to us, whether it's being frightened by the unexpected, whether it's watching ourselves age. Whatever it might be, what we want to have is a spontaneous, loving response. Because it's when we don't that we get ourselves into all kinds of trouble, isn't it? It's amazing to me how well-intentioned we can be and how badly we can act. It stuns me. Just recently, in a very small matter, with a very dear friend, I just very casually said something that I didn't think out clearly enough. And it resulted in, it took quite a lot of time to unravel it. Let's just put it that way. And my remark was extremely hurtful. My intention was not at all. But just somewhere in there, and it was judgmental. It wasn't judgmental of the person, but it was judgmental of an action, of an attitude. And instead of loving it, I just went after it. You know, and we always think we're doing a good thing when we do that. I am the righteous warrior declaring my point of view. You know, I can see what needs to be done and let me help you become better. You know, whatever it might be, in our world, I mean, we may have ulterior motives, but we rarely, rarely really mean to hurt people. But that something comes between ourselves and our ability to really express that. One very comforting thought, which Swami gave me many years ago, which I have never forgotten, is he said that God reads your heart. I remember I had made somebody quite upset with me. Let me think how this whole went. I was trying to be helpful. I meant well. I was so sincere. I was extremely tactless. With a great deal of force. And the individual who was the recipient, the unfortunate recipient of my well-meaning but misguided efforts, decided to take his case to Swami. And Swami Kriyananda took it to him really strongly. And the next day, Swami, you know, just said something to me about it. And of course, everything that had been reported was false, but it didn't matter. I was still in the wrong. And I resigned at that point from the ministry. My resignation was not accepted. But I just had it. I'd had it with the contradiction between the sincerity of intention and the way it's always received. And Swamiji's answer to me was extremely important. He said to me, "You are responsible for your intentions. You are not responsible for how people receive those intentions. Because you can't always control. But you can control what the first impulse of the heart is." Now the problem is, sometimes the first impulse of the heart is, if you were better, then I would be happier. And even though there's an element of goodness in it, there's also this profoundly misguided idea that the world owes you something. You know, that somehow it's supposed to be a certain way. And we spend almost all our time. Swamiji has commented sometimes about the vibration behind certain accents. And he went through a whole cycle of different countries and how they speak and so on. But the Americans, he described an American accent, American speaking English. If you're just wandering around the world and you hear an American speaking English, he said that the national consciousness is outraged innocence. That was his words. Just outraged innocence. You know, it all ought to be like we want it to be. And this is a very fine quality also, but there's just that feeling that the world owes us something. Now, completely contrary to this, well, let me just go to one more piece of this. What happens when we have such a even righteously intended point of view about how things need to be is that we tend then always to be weighing and measuring. And in fact, the word maya, which we tend to translate as delusion, actually means the measurer, the one who measures. Because maya is always measuring. Delusion is always weighing things in the balance. Is this the way it's supposed to be? Is this the way it's not supposed to be? Is this what I was supposed to have done? Is this what I'm not supposed to have done? Are they behaving the way they should behave? Or are they not behaving the way they should behave? Should I actually be aging or should I be eternally youthful? You know, whatever it might be, you know, it's just always weighing and measuring it. And that's the delusion. Because the eternal nature in the affirmation we were doing today, you know, when everything changes, we should always stand changeless in the midst of that. When she was saying that, I thought how interesting that thought would be. You know, to really just watch your life go on around you, but not actually ever really allow yourself to be defined by that. That was Swami Kriyananda's attitude, which was why he was able to manifest so many remarkable attitudes, including this capacity to concentrate, this ability not to be impatient, and this kind acceptance of the reality of people. Because he was never taking this world and cutting it up and saying it should be different than this. It's just is what it is. And we start from what it is. He often talked about, you know, the most essential quality for success in this world is to be able to just see things as they are and work from that. And yes, we can then mold, make destiny different, you know, make success, manifest out of nothing, change ourselves enormously. But it has to begin from an honest position of where we are. I remember this man, this Norwegian man whose name escapes me. You probably know him, the Norwegian man who was with Albert. That was his name. I've been trying to remember his name for about 2 years. Albert, that was his name. I looked at Ramurti and Sita because they knew him. He was Norwegian, and he was a sailor. And in the off-season, he would come and stay at Ananda. He was absolutely wonderfully selfless, and he would just do whatever was asked of him. But I remember that we had a choir. He didn't sing very well, but we didn't have that many singers. And to make it worse, he had a low register, but he insisted on singing tenor. And the reason was because the choir needs tenors. That was his word for it. So he would sing in the tenor section badly, you know. But he was serving because this was what was needed. And he was, you didn't even want to take him out because he was so marvelously wonderful and so utterly misguided. You just didn't know even where to begin with him. Now, what I was beginning to say, which was much more relevant, was once we get into the habit of weighing and measuring, where it always begins to come back to is ourselves. I remember years ago when Jyotish and Devi, who are now the leaders of Ananda after Swami's passing, were teaching the first yoga teacher training courses. This would have been, I don't know, 30 years ago at least. And Devi said when she first started teaching this month-long course, she thought she had the textbook, she had the information, these people needed to learn this, they needed to get the Sanskrit names of all the postures, they had to know the affirmations, they had to get this, they had to do that. And after teaching the course a few times, she had a completely different idea of what her job was. She said, I'm sitting in a room full of angels, and they're all worried that they're not good enough. She said, she just had one job, and that was just to help them understand who they really were. And even more profoundly, help us understand who we are in the eyes of God. And I feel that the one of the best ways to know who we are in the eyes of God is to see who everyone else is in the eyes of God. You know, I contemplate a lot when you hear about really horrific people doing really horrific things, how it must feel for Divine Mother to know that no matter who or what they are, they're equally her own child. You have to think about that. I mean, a mother, every person in the world has a mother somewhere. And mothers have, I mean, mother is the traditional image. I can say fathers, but we have this feeling of unconditional love, really. You know, what happens to us at Christmas with the baby is that we all begin to be able to sort of touch in that freedom that a baby gives us. Because a baby doesn't weigh and measure. Babies are just, you know, marvelously indifferent. I remember my dear friend with one of his little boys sort of just he was in our house and he was going up the step with the baby, and how the babies just spontaneously erp whatever they've eaten. You know, and this just, he just, he's carrying the baby like this, and the baby throws up all over the back of his shirt and throws up all over the stairs and the carpet, you know, just like that. But what I enjoyed the most was how completely unconcerned the baby was. You know, it's like, here I am, and what's going to happen now is my breakfast is just going to come back out again. And it didn't mean anything to him that it happened. And I was thinking about just how we're not so different, are we? Oh, here's some little childhood trauma, and I'm just going to throw it up on you. You know, it just comes out of us. Just myself the other day with my just casual little remark, just without a moment's hesitation. I just thought, oh, I think I'll just give something awful to you. Why would I do that? I don't know. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But what we have to do is just train ourselves all the time. Now, these poor little virgins wandering around with their little lamps with nothing in them, you know, it's just such a complicated story. And then the bridegroom comes, and then they go out, and they're shopping, and maybe the clerk was inattentive, or the first store they went to wasn't there, and then they had to go to the next one, and they were looking for organic oil, and there wasn't organic oil. And you know, you're just like, what kept them? Why couldn't they just get the oil? You know, but what we're talking about is that they just were going through the motions. There was no sweetness in their relationship to God. And that was their failure. There was no sweetness in it. They'd forgotten what this relationship is really all about. And they were still carrying their little lanterns around, but there was nothing in it that made it actually light. And the reality of all of us is we have this infinite potential to care about each other. We are perfectly capable of perfect love. It's wonderful to just sit inside your own self and imagine, what would it be like really to love everyone? I was with Swami at Disneyland once. I wrote this story up, so many of you have heard it, but Swami used to like to take us to Disneyland. For one, he thought that he thought Walt Disney himself was just a superb karma yogi, because he said he never did anything halfway. Disneyland has changed, but it was very innocent in the years we used to go, and very bright and extremely conscientious. Just everything was done to the nth degree, and he liked us to go and see what it looked like to do something really well. It was also imaginative and lighthearted, and he would take crowds of us there at different times, Swami knew Disneyland very well, and he had all his favorite places and troops of people. I have several experiences of crowds of people running along behind Swamiji from this display to that ride to this restaurant. And one night we were there, and it was, I mean, these are like half a dozen times over a lifetime. This wasn't like once a month we go to Los Angeles, but everybody was gathering for the electric parade. And we were standing there, and there were hundreds of people within view. And I just remember Swami just turned and said, imagine not only loving all these people, and we sort of looked at all these people with their babies, and he said, but being every one of these individuals. And then he said, that was Master's consciousness. He was inside every aspect of creation. And Swami just sort of said that, and then this elevated mood just infected all dozen of us who were with him. And we sat down on the sidewalk right there to meditate. And this whole crowd, we just meditated until the light things were coming in front of us. And then we sort of came up from this meditation. We were all surrounded by people, but this whole crowd, we had just been sitting there. And it was chaotic and noisy, but we were absolutely silent in our meditation, because everything going on around us was the experience of the divine. Because of just that simple thought of Swami, this is not separate from me. It's not that I try hard to love all these different people, some of them quite icky or anything like that. It's merely that I look out, and what I see is I just see the same power of spirit that's moving in me. I mean, these are marvelous exercises when you're just driving down the road. I was coming in today, and this man was walking across El Camino. My car was stopped. He's coming across El Camino. He's wearing flip-flops, which made me think maybe it was warm enough for me to ride my bicycle instead of driving my car. And then he's sort of in a jacket like this, and he has some can in his hand, the label of which I can't see. I suspect it was not soda. He has a cigarette like this, and he's just kind of moving across. And I said, I just sort of looked over at him, and I thought, perhaps you should have reconsidered what you did last night. But I was also just watching him, and I was just trying to think, you know, there is no less divinity manifested in this man than there is in the masters. You know, all are equal. This is what we say at the end of the Festival of Light every day, light every week. You know, all are created equal, not just Jesus Christ, Lord Krishna, but even those who have sinned most greatly. This man did not look like he had the energy to sin greatly. I think he sinned modestly. But I also looked at him and I thought, we don't need to have a punishing God. It's just not necessary, because his experience of his own actions is sufficient. And I began to think about myself and all the rest of us who are over conscientious about whether we're doing the right thing and all of these different things. And then we imagine that God is as small-minded as we are. But he doesn't need to punish us. He doesn't need to think ill of us, because our own actions are sufficient. And by that, what I mean is the contrast between the sweetness of love and acceptance and the small-mindedness that we accidentally express, that contrast is punishment enough. And that's really how God guides us. He doesn't guide us by edict or by anything like that. We ourselves separate ourselves from our own potential joyousness. And after a while, that becomes agonizing. There's a scene in the movie about Saint Bernadette of Lourdes, who had the vision of Mary. And whether or not the scene is true, I don't actually know, but it could be true. And she's toward the end of her life. She died young. I don't know if this was her actual deathbed or one of her three or four almost deathbeds that she went through. But she was so unhappy because she was remembering when their family was very poor and her mother had made some kind of soup out of just whatever bits of food they could find. And she hadn't appreciated her mother's effort. And she was feeling so much pain in her heart, remembering the pain she had caused her mother. Now, of course, one hopes not to be trapped by such thoughts on one's deathbed. But I thought to myself, when I remember seeing that scene, which stayed in my mind so vividly, you know, once we begin to realize that we don't only love everyone, but we are everyone. You know, just the least suffering that we cause, we just cause it to ourselves. And the contrast between the joy of loving and the pain of causing pain, that's all we need. You know? And you have to understand that Divine Mother rejoices when we begin to understand. So we have this idea that once we've uncovered a flaw, we're so embarrassed, we don't want anyone else to know, we don't want God to know, we feel it's just made us completely unworthy. But I remember when I'd had this terrible negative attitude toward this person, and I really thought I had overcome it. But what had actually happened is I didn't have to see them anymore. And so circumstances allowed that we could be together again, and I overestimated my freedom and put myself in close proximity, which took about 4 minutes for me to just completely lose all good attitude. It was awful. And as it happened, I was riding in the car with Swami, and I was so upset about it. I was weeping and just, I was beside myself. You know, I'd been working on this for so long, and I thought I was free. Swami's attitude was so casual. Well, he said, you thought you had overcome it. You weren't putting out any energy to overcome it. And just so simply said, now you know, like that. And I mean, all this other cascade of things was happening now that I know. But when he said it like that, I thought, well, in fact, now I know. And that's really good news, isn't it? Now I know. And for those who are helping us, who believe in our goodness because they don't just love us, they are inside of us. It's just like something goes wrong and they say, well, now you know. Now you're absolutely miserable because you've made such a mess of it. You know, I've just been watching you this whole time. You think the guru doesn't watch? You think God doesn't know? Of course he does. And when he sees you fall apart, then you know the poor man with his beer can and his cigarette, you know? It's like, okay, was that really a good idea, what you did last night? Or maybe there's a better way to spend Sunday morning than this? But she's just delighted. And if maybe you didn't learn it today, maybe you'll learn it next week. And if not next week, then next incarnation. And if not that one, then we'll do 50 of them. Because Maya measures. God is always the same. And it's no small challenge to live there. But it's the only challenge worth accepting. Because otherwise, the fruit is our own misery. And really, who wants any of that? And who wants to be the instrument of that for anyone around us? It's not enough merely to love each other. We have to realize that we are, you know? And she and he, and they're all with us, and it's all just the same. You know, Christmas is a time out from delusion. And the more profoundly we embrace it, the more it will stay with us forever. God bless you.